Thanks. It's really great to be reading in this series. So thanks, Mark. Aphids. When they let me go, I didn't know the language of the place where I was, nor did I know the name of the place. And the shoes I was wearing, black canvas sneakers with white laces, I didn't know where they had come from. My knees and ankles ached because I'd been kneeling for so long. It felt good to walk, even if I didn't know where I was walking. A woman in a white raincoat and with a red kerchief on her hair came walking towards me, then walked right by me. Soon it happened again, but this time with a young man. These were other people. Amid the rows of houses that lined the road was what appeared to be a store. It had signs outside and a smiling chipmunk cut out of thin wood. Before they let me go, they'd stuffed some paper money into my pocket, so I walked into the store. I said to the man at the counter that I was thirsty. He had a very thin black mustache and no eyebrows. It was like he had taken his eyebrows and stuck them under his nose. He frowned when I spoke. I withdrew one of the bills from my pocket with one hand and pointed to my mouth with the other. I licked my lips. The man swept his own hand through the air in front of him, and I looked around his store. The shelves were lined with animals constructed out of twigs. I saw giraffes and gazelles and flamingos and porcupines, but I didn't see any water. The man stepped around the corner and took my arm. He led me back out to the street and pointed towards the crest of a hill. With his slender hand flat, he made the motion of a fish leaping and said something I didn't understand. Then he turned his hand as if to slice something and slalomed it through the air between us. This was a fish swimming. Then he held an invisible ladle to his mouth, puckered his lips, and slurped. Over the hill there was a river. I could drink from the river. On my way up the hill, I passed dozens more houses, but I saw no more people. The people were all in their houses. Before I knelt in the dark, I had been in a house. I wanted to knock on their doors, knock on the doors of these other people who were inside, and tell them they weren't safe. As I approached the top of the hill, I could see dark clouds hovering above the road, which was by now made only of dirt. My black canvas sneakers were turning gray. It wasn't long before I stepped into those frenetic clouds, and I realized they were swarms of aphids. They burrowed into my hair and ricocheted off my cheeks. They played in my eyelashes and among the follicles in my nostrils. I could only squint now because the aphids wanted to swim on the surfaces of my eyeballs. But down the other side of the hill, I could see a river that wound and curved like a child's crayon scribble on a piece of paper. When I'd had enough of playing, I stepped from the clouds of aphids and felt the pain in my ankles again as I walked slowly downhill. At the side of the river, I tried to crouch, but couldn't bend my knees. The water was cool and clear, the bed adorned with colorful round pebbles. I puckered my lips and sucked as hard as I could, but I couldn't draw the water up to my mouth. It was down there. I was up here. I stood beside the river. The sun never went down. Here's a bunch of recent poems. Now, some of these poems were written sort of in exchange with a Chicago poet friend of mine named Richard Huddle. We just send each other poems back and forth, see if they spark anything. But they're not collaborative poems, so this is just my side of the exchange. I peer through the trees. A horse stands amid a cluster of brush, swatting at flies with its tail. An old man pushes a baseball glove along the ground with a stick. A child crouches beneath a wooden bench, sobbing. He wears a dark suit with a Donald Duck necktie. A tarantula grips the ground, about to leap. Or maybe it's dead. Or maybe it's not a tarantula. An empty bag of Fritos corn chips rocks gently on the surface of a pond. Men, women, and children are filing by slowly. It is a funeral procession. As so frequently happens, I have missed the coffin. A squirrel leaps into an electric chair and straps itself in. It is taking responsibility. And this poem, I think, is maybe going to be the title of my next poetry book, if there's a next poetry book. It's called Don't Touch People's Heads. He touched her head, but people said, "Don't touch people's heads," but it was just a head on the lady's shoulders. The president described himself as vigilant and bosomy, and the media fell into step. They helped him sort stuff out for his big garage sale. The monkey turned out to be a furry fire alarm, waking every American citizen and chasing him out the door. "Voluptuous," said the headlines. Chilly reverie. I lay back in the lawn chair on my snow-covered lawn, and Robert Frost pretends to massage my scalp, though actually he is looking for head lice. I strum a banjo, a song for Strom Thurmond, the kindly gentleman from South Carolina, dead of niceness at age 179. Danny Kaye, Kay Ballard, and Lenny Kaye, I saw him at St. Mark's, delivered eulogies, each distinct as a snowflake. I got a new gig figuring out all that Iraq stuff, and I bought a nice shirt from Goodwill to do it in. Robert Frost, you are my relaxing formula, my communist, as my neighbor downstairs howls obscenities at himself, trying to fit his head in a crack in the wall. This is what I most love about winter. Sandals with straps. I was lying in the gutter, telling untruths, and I found six words. Yet, glow, fiend, infestation, expedient, and fungi. Words were something I had never before considered, especially in sixes, but rarely even in twos. A passing Mountie handed me a pen and some paper, and I wrote, yet the fungi infestation glows expediently like a fiend. I waited for my grade 8 teacher, Mrs. Pennell, to walk by, she who once showed us, in sandals with straps, how to walk sexy. Look, I told her, a sentence. She was old now, but not as much older than me as she used to be. She took the paper from my hand and tucked it into her jacket pocket and slid into a car, and the car took off into the sky above my head and above my house, and I said, shit, it's the future already. Secret country. Secret country. I look at my watch. It is 10 to the moment when I climb into a shoebox. 10 minutes later, I climb into the box that held my black canvas all-stars, the ones I wore to Nicaragua in 1996 when Joe wore the same and we became Los Zapatos Negros, twin-footed gringos, or one gringo and one canadiense, and I look for those days. I'm always looking for days that have vanished in the depths of the shoebox, and I pull the lid on over me and see my destiny. I secede from Canada, form a Sandinista government here in the shoebox. I have 100% support of the citizens of the shoebox. I eliminate polio and promote literacy, free textbooks for every child. I nationalize the industries, spread the wealth, and every politician is a poet. Weeks pass in my paradise, then years. I become dissatisfied. The country is cramped, like my limbs, which I haven't stretched in ages. I topple myself and install myself. Nothing changes. And this is the last of those exchanges with Richard Huddle. It's called, a man with taped up glasses entered the room with a shopping bag bursting with what appeared to be old books. I'm just kidding. I stand here, my arm outstretched, a leaflet between my fingers, my eyes closed, my lips slightly parted while the citizens purchase the thing advertised, then rush to their torture appointments. Music will kill you and then retire to a bungalow in North Tonawanda down the street from a new Slurpee outlet. I think I'll read that one now. There's a little story here called The Interview. My feet have touched more pavement than dirt. When I say pavement, I refer to everything that is not dirt. When I say dirt, I refer to everything that is not pavement. Actually, I must expand on this. When I say pavement, I include the floor of my father's car, I include the monkey bars in the park, I include the hardwood surface of my bedroom floor, I include the carpet in my aunt's living room and den. I also have to throw in escalators, linoleum, and the endless metal fields of my dreams. When I say dirt, I refer to water and to grass and to sand. I must include mud, which is a combination of two of the above elements. Also, the emerging roots of old trees, the trunks of trees, and rocks. Rocks are very important. I've spent a bit of time on rocks, and it was quality time. But I've spent more time on pavement. It feels so much more molecular, like flesh, which is something I haven't categorized yet, but I think maybe it's half dirt and half pavement. Where had I gotten to? Oh yeah, I'm 11 years old, and Larry Stein is sitting on my chest with his hands pinning my arms down. I am lying on my back on pavement, and I'm trying to squirm my way out of this. A crowd begins to form around us, and I see Debbie Larker. She is puny and has dark hair, and her mother is missing several fingers. Surely I would someday marry her. I found this out about her mother's fingers when I went to work Went to her house to work on a geography project we were forced to do together. And now Debbie is watching me lie on my back under Larry Stein, so I have to try and act nonchalant to appear in control. I have an idea, and I put it into action. Larry, I say, you're such a homo. Get off of me. Larry's grip on my arms loosens a bit, and as the circulation returns to them, I can feel all the little pebbles that have become embedded in my elbows. I peer beyond Larry's shoulder, but I can no longer see Debbie among the spectators. You're the homo, Larry says to me, a double homo. I wiggle about a bit, try to rock from side to side, but I can't get out from under Larry, and when I try to reach up and shove him off, his fingers dig into my arms again. I have many loyal friends, and they are sprinkled through the crowd, joining in the growing chant, which deals with what a double homo I am. When I lose my temper, I'm careful not to smash things. I would get in so much trouble, and also I might destroy something I'll later miss. So what I do is shove my furniture around. I have a bed, and this I shove diagonally across the room, knocking over a chair. I push my desk away from the wall as well and slide it in front of the door. This way my brother can't get in and see me crying. My bookcase is attached to the wall, so I can't move it, but I take down great armloads of books and stack them on the floor. I'm careful because I don't want to wreck their covers. I also pull my dresser out of the corner and turn it carefully on its side. When I'm done shoving everything around, I flop myself onto my bed and become like jelly. I sob and yell into my pillow, and it is my room, a room I have control over. I wiggle and wobble on my bed until my tears have run dry and I have fallen asleep into the world of endless metal fields. I think we've reached my 17th year, or perhaps my 34th. Regardless, what happens is my self-esteem begins to mistakenly build, and I can actually talk to people and occasionally look them in the eye. So an old man comes into the library where I'm working, and he asks if I play chess. I guess I look now like the type who plays chess. I look down at his fingers, and they are thin and bent in strange directions. I figure he must be good. I tell him I play, but not well. We agree to meet in the park beside the library later on, and he will bring his chessboard. We do this for years, every day playing chess for hours, so that I have to sneak in through my bedroom window so my parents don't get angry. I must be 17. The old man's name is Schaefer, Mr. Schaefer, and as we play, he tells me about his ailing wife in his thick German accent. He loves her very much, and his eyes water as he talks. His eyes are always watering. I wonder if when you get that old, everything just seems so sad. I become a stronger player with every game of chess. Mr. Schaefer loans me books to study by Zinosko Borofsky and Ruben Fine and Emanuel Lasker. I study the classic openings, learn about the strength of the measly pawn, go through the endgames until I know them inside out. But still, after 3 years, the score is 612 games to zero. Since my self-esteem is so enormous, I feel I have a chance of catching up. It's only a matter of time. But before I have the opportunity, a strange thing happens. An old woman meets me in the park. She asks my name. I tell her. Klaus is dead, she says. I look down at her gnarled fingers and say, I didn't know his name was Klaus. Can I go now? You can probably figure out the rest of my life based on what I've just told you. It follows a predictable pattern with few surprises. I will leave you hair samples and nail clippings, which might be some help as well. If you have any questions, you can call me. Besides, I'm late now. I have to pick up my mother's belongings. A few more poems here. A few of these poems are going to be in the book I Cut My Finger, which there's a little leaflet at the front table there where Rod and I are desperately trying to sell our books this evening. And it's a free leaflet, and on the back, there's a poem in it, and on the back it has the date and place of the book launch, which is also book launch for Kate Sutherland and for Clint Burnham. The earth is bored. It rummages through the table scraps, silences the roses. My dream was an awful mistake, a zombie, a teabag. You, however, are a person, a thing with words, a sheet of newsprint. It's easy not to leave a soft, mute fading, sealed off in a high school play. You proclaimed the inconvenient suit of captivity. You chewed the unheard voices, exhausted, clutching your brown lunch bag. Please trust my vengeance, my toll booth built of bones and aluminum, settled by the cool pond. My lapel. 1. I lose my horoscope. My horoscope speaks to me. I, its mother, swim out to sea and become learning, become decorum. A flood of monsters arises at noon and shows us what it has written. What it has written is certainty, regrets. 2. A breeze diverged from wisdom. A book grew into the dark corners of a dank room. To be continued. 3. I mumbled to the frost. I asked for forgiveness. I wore a label on my left ankle. The label said, "The air behaves strangely. Too late. A voyage of dreams holds promise. I repeat, a voyage of dreams holds an air mattress." I watched the girls' dresses of smoke, dresses of oak and ivy. Another time, our opinions were polluted. I was so ignorant, I cried. I wrapped myself in wallpaper and tried to shine like the brightest star. 4. In darkness, the secrets grew like huge red flowers, their fumes an elixir. Success came later and urgently. It shifted like the steam of promise. The crows are my children. The mudslide is my original idea. I sleep, I pray, a remnant with no memory and no itinerary. A decade nods, renounces that which is near. I pin soup on my lapel. I exist. Oh, this is a little poem I wrote for Mark, actually. This is for Mark, the organizer of the series. It's called Wealth Kingdom. When Marlon Perkin dies, he belongs to everyone, not just those who cried or he caught. A little story here. Maybe I'll just read a couple more stories. See what happens. Time here. Buying cigarettes for the dog. You say you don't know why I'm hiding in a stinking alleyway playing Beethoven symphonies on the lids of garbage cans and masturbating to the memory of my dead wife. I could turn it around and ask you the same thing, Jack. Why you're living in a three-bedroom house in Oakville with a blind woman named Elaine Trumbo and painting racing stripes down the sides of your sweatpants. Consider the damage the war has done. Consider the nonstop cough of car horns shattering the windows of roadside motels. Consider this. With each year, since we were small children drinking warm water from garden hoses and playing croquet until dark, I have become 1 year older, and there's been no stopping this temporal onslaught. The years pushed me out of my parents' house and slapped me around behind the plaza where we used to buy bags of chips for 5 cents and Archie comics for 12 cents. I like grape ice cream and you like Spumoni, perhaps because your last name was Spumoni. Better Spumoni than Sputum, the motto that made you school president. Better Jack than Jism. Better Betty than Wilma, and Betty than Veronica too. Better beaten and gasping than dead and impaled on a street steering wheel like Bobby Fishbaum, his car crumpled into the monkey bars we used to play on. Better not forget to take your medication, even when you've got to refill your water glass to get through all those fucking capsules. Better beggar than Beagle. She's dead, but I did not leave her. I stepped out the door, looking back over my shoulder and shouting, "Going for smokes!" And you never know where life's journey is going to take you, like you never know how the years are going to shove you around. I walked down the street and sauntered into the convenience store like the happiest man alive, which I was, and I bought a pack of Rothmans, I can't remember whether or not there was an apostrophe, even though I probably went through several thousand packs, which is to say one per year, until I was 3012, my current age, though I wear the years well. When I left the shop, I turned right and I cut through the synagogue parking lot and I ended up at the highway where I waited until I could dash across, first to the median and then to the other side. In the distant apartment building rose black against the inky blue sky, and smoke churned out of chimneys and blended with the dark clouds. I was thinking about her as I walked back, although back ended up being the opposite direction as I decided to circle the globe and still be home in time for dinner. I was in the land of factories by the time I could walk no more, at least for that day, and I climbed a fence and tried some doors and finally found my way into a building that billed itself as Foundry Jimenez, and I crawled into a mold that fit my body exactly. Jack, I did not know then that she was dying. She hadn't told me, and you wouldn't have known it to look at her or even to fuck her, which I hope you never did, though occasionally the glances that passed between you and my wife did not go unnoticed by my bloodshot peepers. Oh, there was sleep that night, and a siren in the morning, and footsteps, and the clanging of machinery, and blows to my face, perhaps by Jimenez himself. I was offered a job and given a small apartment with a dog and a typewriter named Princey. They were both named Princey, and years passed. I made beautiful things. They were shiny and useful, and you probably have one now in your kitchen in Oakville. I worked and took my morning break and worked and took my lunch and ate a sandwich with cheese and grasped for straws and finding an undrank straight from the glass and worked some more and went home. I pitted Princey, both of them, and after several years remembered I was running an errand. My journey home was filled with fairy tale marvels. The world had changed so much I barely recognized it. The sidewalks were filled with tiny desks and computer stations, and seated at each was a child, slumped and pale, tapping the keys while resting their foreheads against the monitors. They hummed and rocked and screamed, and their fingers kept tapping, Jack. And when I looked a little closer, I saw that their fingers rarely touched anything but numbers. Imagine a world of numbers and nothing else. A world where dog, cat, spumoni, and tree do not exist. Only numbers, endless trains of numbers, spreading like viruses across the fingerprints of our youth. I couldn't help but think that if they'd only kept the price down in Archie Comics, none of this would have come to pass. And that thought kept me occupied until I finally reached my house, realizing I had already smoked all those Rothmans and would have nothing to show for my absence. As I reached for the doorknob, I felt something tugging at my ankle, and it was Princey, the dog, not the typewriter. I knelt down and petted his head. He'd come so far, he'd been so loyal. I went to push open the door, but it wouldn't budge. I made a fist and banged some more. I remember the children tapping out numbers on computer keyboards, and I wondered if perhaps I now had children. The door swung open, and a woman stood there. But she was not my wife. She wore an apron with a carrot and a picture of Jackie Gleason. I had never seen her before. I explained my thing, and she explained her thing, and then she put her hand on my shoulder and nodded sympathetically. She offered me a cigarette and asked me to come in. By in, she meant away from the outside, to within the walls of the house I used to own, where I lived with my wife, whose insides, although I didn't know it, she'd never told me, were being eaten away by termites. The woman who lived here now, this new woman, offered me a place to sleep for the night, but I asked her only to look after Princey, and she said her daughter had always wanted a dog, and I told her about the other Princey, the typewriter, and how, if her child was one of those number-tapping ones, she wouldn't even know what a typewriter was. I asked her, are there still typewriters? Are there still telephone answering machines? What about Red Skelton and Tony Orlando and Kim Novak and Cracker Jacks? What about the American Bald Eagle? I began to weep. Nothing was the same anymore. The woman who lived here now in my house gave me directions to the cemetery where my wife was buried and told me to come back anytime. In the streets, with the light cold rain beginning to fall, I marveled over the old neighborhood. It was like I'd never left, except that everything was different. There, just down the block, was the store where I'd bought the smokes. But it wasn't a store anymore, it was a sign studio. I crossed the street and pushed open the door. A man was perched in a chair across the room, his back to me, his hand holding a brush suspended over a sign in progress. What's it say? He asked. And I replied that I couldn't see, that he was in the way, and he said, no, the sign you want, what's it say? Did I want a sign? Did I want this man to paint me a sign? He must have been right, because otherwise why had I come into his shop? I had never before imagined having a sign, Jack, but suddenly I knew that a man without a sign is a wanderer, an nonentity, a golem, a bit actor you recognize, but whose name you can never remember. I had no money to pay this man for a sign and no plot of land to drive it into. I've got nowhere to put it, I told him. And without turning, he replied, you don't need no place except your back. I can make you a sandwich board. I told him this was a big decision, and he agreed. And I told him perhaps I'd curl up in the back alley behind his shop if he didn't mind. That was where, as a teenager, I'd smoked my first cigarette, and I'd ponder the wording. I'd rake my nicotine-stained fingers through my hair and settle on something. I'd choose an epitaph or a slogan or a wedding proposal. I'd find the words, Jack, maybe five or six, that would tell my wife why I walked out of that house and circled the globe and missed the birth of our children, why I wasn't there to stop the termites that ate out her guts, why I hated myself and bandaged myself to a crevice between two garbage cans where dogs sniffed at my fetid crotch while I slept and I dreamed of Betty and of Spumoni ice cream and the perfect six words to express to my wife the exquisiteness of my love for her. A few years back, I invented this character named Rozovsky to write poems about. Rozovsky would have been the name of my dad's family, and they cleverly changed it to Ross, which was a far more distinct and interesting name. And I always regretted that. I always wanted the name Rozovsky to appear in my books. So I invented this character named Rozovsky, and a few years ago, I published a book called Rozovsky at Peace, and it was just good to have the name on the title. But the Rozovsky character sort of stuck around. And I thought I'd read, I had two more Rozovsky poems kicking around here. Oh, yeah. Rozovsky and the River of Blindness. Rozovsky waded through the water, through reeds and bobbing plastic burger containers. Scum swam around his thighs, regrouping behind him, laughing. Oh, scum. Television splashed in the rocks near the shore, a man waving a megaphone filled all the screens. Above him, a sun of yellow construction paper fluttered behind some clouds, coughed like a grandfather, fell asleep on the couch. An invisible marching band followed along at the banks, playing the anthem of each shtetl he passed. Rozovsky had these eyebrows that crashed against his eyes. He cracked his knuckles and lapped at his lips. Rozovsky pushed against the wind, his loose book pages flat past his face. Polish, Yiddish, Russian, Hebrew, English, German. He'd been walking this river since before he was born, and today he'd step out and see his own feet and feel the ground beneath them, sometimes solid, sometimes giving, and he'd walk up to a shack and pass through a door and sit down to eat dinner, and he'd look at each face at the table, and each would have a nose in the middle, and he too would have a nose. Everyone would have a nose, and each nose two nostrils, so many nostrils, and he would begin to tell everyone about his years in the river, and the glorious shimmer of the moon would pour from his mouth. And this is the most recent one, Rozovsky in space. The aisles are cramped, the hardwood floor covered in sawdust and raisins. Rozovsky takes slow and unsteady steps, fingertips grazing the shelves that rise taller than his gray hair on either side. It smells of mothballs here, but also hot chocolate, and from the back room, the sound of a sewing machine, the rise and fall of a cast iron pedal, the staccato insistence of hems being stitched. A minute ago, Rozovsky had been floating in space, false teeth drifting by and hunks of metal flashing like cameras. In a photo album somewhere back on Earth, Rozovsky stands grinning in a field just off a single-lane road, his black hair flickering in a barely perceptible breeze. His long coat, too, is black, and his arm wraps around a woman in fur who laughs at the camera. Behind them, the sky is clear, blends into the photo's border, and a thin band of leafless trees reaches across the horizon. When he gets to the back of the shop, Rozovsky pushes aside a curtain, steps into a tiny room lit by a single light bulb. A man in a vest and rolled up white sleeves turns from his Singer sewing machine. It is Blatt. A few strands of white hair lie on his glistening scalp, and a strand of black thread hangs from the corner of his mouth. Blatt was an astronaut too, once. He points to a chair, and Rozovsky sits down. They strap themselves in and wait for liftoff. I'm going to read one more thing here. One more story. The President's Cold Legs. The President fell into the river and his legs got cold and he ended up in a wheelchair. I was pushing him along the sidewalk, and someone with lots of shopping bags stopped us and said, "Did you know that's the president you're pushing there in that wheelchair?" Well, sure I knew. This was the president with the cold legs. Later on in my room, I wrote in my notebook, "The president likes how I push him along the sidewalk." Then I put my pencil down and waited for the phone to ring again. Whenever they needed to push the president in his wheelchair, they would phone me up, and I would go to his house. I noticed that the wallpaper up near the ceiling was beginning to peel. I'd tell the president about that the next time I pushed him along the sidewalk. I mean, he wouldn't fix it himself because of his cold legs and all, but he'd send someone to stick my peeling wallpaper back up. And also, my pencil was worn down to just about a stub. I hoped that maybe he could get me a new pencil. He would say, "I will give you money for a new pencil because of how good you pushed me on the sidewalk." We'd stop outside a drugstore and he'd give me a handful of change and tell me to go in and buy a new pencil. I don't like to leave him alone like that, but he says he's safe because he's a good president and everybody likes him. Aside from pushing the president along on the sidewalk, I do other things too. At night, I sleep. Also, when I was a little boy, I took my dog Rufus for walks, but not with a wheelchair. Rufus sniffed the back ends of other dogs that other boys were walking. I got a B in geography once. In the school band, we played a song called "Suicide is Painless," which was the song they played on a TV show that everyone watched then. My father really liked that show a lot, and later he jumped off a big building, so I don't know what that means. Like most subjects, history was not my best subject at school, and sometimes when I push the president in his wheelchair, I get scared he'll ask me a question where I have to know who was another president in history. I tried once to memorize the names of every president, but all I could remember was Spumoni, because it was hot and I wanted ice cream. Once at the post office, I was standing in line to buy some stamps, and a man with a little hat came over and did a dance in front of me. It lasted a long time, and when it was finished, he said, "Will you hire me now?" Which probably meant would I hire him to do a dance, but I needed my money for stamps, and I couldn't afford it. Later, when I was pushing the president along the sidewalk, I asked him if he wanted to hire the man with the little hat to do a dance for him. He didn't say words, he just laughed, and I laughed too. but I didn't know why we were laughing. Every year I have a birthday, but no one told me when I started, so I don't know how old I am. I don't know whether I am younger or older than the president. I think that I am younger, though, because he calls me son. If I was older, he would call me father. One time when it was my birthday, the president gave me a tape recording. He said that the man on the tape was a man named Hank Williams, and he liked them best of all singers, and that I reminded him of Hank Williams. I stopped pushing the president's wheelchair for a moment, and I looked at the picture of the man on the tape. He had a cowboy hat on, but I wasn't wearing a hat. The president must have made a mistake. When I got home that day, I tore the plastic paper off the tape recording, which I had to use my teeth to do. I went to the door of my next-door neighbor, who was a nice woman with very big teeth and a blue dress, and I asked her if she could play the tape for me because I don't have a tape recorder. She said okay and that I should come in and sit down. Then she put the tape the president gave me for my birthday in her tape recorder, and she asked me where I got the tape. "The president with the cold legs," I told her. And just as I said that, we heard music, just like those were the magic words that made the tape start singing. Me and the nice woman listened to the whole tape of Hank Williams, and then we listened to it again. "He seems very sad," the woman said to me. In my room, I lay in bed and thought about sadness and how I feel sorry for people who are sad. I wondered why people would feel sad if it makes them so sad. I tried to make myself sad by thinking about that my parents were dead and that I didn't know how old I was and that my pencil was really short and that if the president's legs hadn't gotten so cold when he fell in the river, he'd be able to walk around like normal people. But nothing made me feel sad. Sometimes when I push the president along the sidewalk, I can see that he is sad, but he doesn't sing songs like Hank Williams that sound like he's crying. I push his wheelchair faster so that he will have fun, and I tell him funny stories about my dog Rufus. For example, sometimes when I walked him, he would smell the back ends of other dogs that other boys were walking. Plus, when he got killed by the car in front of our house, my father held him up by his rear legs, and it looked like he was smiling the way his tongue hung out of his mouth. "You shouldn't fall in a river because the river makes your legs cold and then you can't walk and I have to push you around in a wheelchair along the sidewalk. And I don't really have time for that because I have to push the president. And when I'm not pushing him, I have to sit in my room and look at my phone until somebody somewhere else dials my number and makes it ring." When the president turns dead because the cold goes up from his legs into his heart, I will have to be the president. I will sit in his wheelchair and a man will push me along the sidewalk. When the man's pencil gets so short he can't even hold it or feel it into the sharpener, I will give him money to buy a new pencil. "Faster! Push me faster!" I'll yell when I'm sad. Then I'll point at a rock on the ground and say, "We sure are moving faster than that rock!" Maybe when I am the president, I will know how to be sad. With a pencil, I will write a book about rocks and about sadness. When my pencil gets short, a man will bring me another pencil. My friends from school, although I did not have any friends at school, will come and visit me in my house. I will have a tape recorder when I am the president, and I will play my Hank Williams tape that the president gave me. I will tell my friends, "The president gave me this tape." When I pushed him along the sidewalk, I looked like Hank Williams, even if I didn't wear a hat. And then my friends, which I don't have, will say how sad Hank Williams sounds. And I'll say that I know what they mean, because I will be the president. Thanks very much.